Welcome to the Founders Odyssey podcast, where we interview founders who have bought companies, sold companies, raised funds, taken their companies public, and have innovative products or services to share to the world. My name is Nathan Bird, and I will be your host today. It is our distinct pleasure to introduce to you an innovative founder and entrepreneur, David Oldham, founder of Awesome, enabling private companies to use their equity to reward and motivate customers. Let us welcome David Oldham to the Founders Odyssey today. How you doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having me. This is great. Yeah.
You excited to be on the podcast?
Oh, yeah. I love podcasts.
You know, we've got a lot to touch on, and you have an amazingly innovative product for sure, and a service that's really, truly, and I believe this can really revolutionize the industry, of every industry,
yeah.
To be honest with you,
yeah.
Not just technology. But first, let's take it all the way back to where you first began, but also share with us, what does entrepreneurship mean to you?
That's a great question. Man, I'll have to think about that for a second. All the way back, let's see. Okay, so I started my first lemonade stand when I was, it's kind of funny, I'm joking, but I was talking a little bit about this on another podcast, but this idea of, are entrepreneurs born or bred? Is it nature or nurture? Like, are you born an entrepreneur, or do you just learn to become an entrepreneur? And in my case, it's probably a little bit of both, but I definitely had this weird bug when I was a little kid of like wanting to do business, like wanting to do entrepreneurial things. And I mean, a lot of kids do, right? A lot of lemonade stands, a lot of lawn mowing, a lot of that kind of stuff. But the weird thing about me, and I don't know where this came from. Nobody taught me to do this. My parents didn't suggest that I do it this way, which is kind of natural to me, that I would set up a lemonade stand, but then I would hire my friends to man the lemonade stand. So I was, you know, like just the CEO or the boss, and I would out like be hustling, like walking up and down the street and trying to get people to come there. But I'd have people like manning the lemonade stand. And every once in a while I'd like go take a break and leave. But, you know, people were manning the lemonade stand. And then the same thing with like lawn mowing and, you know, landscaping, fence painting. I would always like land the gigs, like get the jobs, but then I would get my friends and other people to like do the work, mm-hmm. And pay them to do the work. But I always had kind of this, you know, entrepreneur sort of manager mindset rather than like just doing the stuff. And I honestly don't know where that came from, really. It was just the way that I thought was like a better way to do it. And I was always thinking about, you know, if I was just selling the lemonade, I could only sell so much. But if I had like five people selling the lemonade and I had like three lemonade stands on three different corners, I could make so much more money. It was just always kind of the way that my brain worked, right? So later on in life, I actually, coming out of college, I was going to go to med school. Took the MCAT, got accepted to a few different med schools, and then decided not to go. And then kind of pursued the entrepreneurship path. But back then, entrepreneurship wasn't cool. It wasn't a thing. It wasn't, you know, people don't talk about it like they talk about it now. And there wasn't like the infrastructure. There wasn't like a group of entrepreneurs that were kind of known, cool, you know, mentors or people that you could aspire to be like or whatever. My dad was an entrepreneur, but he bootstrapped his business for almost 20 years before it really took off. And so my vision of entrepreneurship was, it is a grind. It's super hard. He works crazy hard hours and it was super stressful. And I had a neighbor who was a doctor, a surgeon, and he drove a Porsche. He had lots of money, nice house, and seemed to have a pretty cush schedule. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, oh, I want to be a doctor. I don't want to be an entrepreneur. But then when I got to the point of actually choosing that path, I had worked with a lot of doctors kind of in internship / just volunteer kind of roles. And I would always ask them, if you could go back and do this all again, would you do the exact same thing? And a lot of them said no, which kind of shocked me. And so then I started to really think, like, hey, is this my purpose? Is this really what I want to do with my life? Or am I just doing this because I thought it was like prestige and lots of money and, you know, that kind of thing? And I really had to dig into that. I got accepted to school so that I for sure had the option. But then once I got accepted, I deferred for a little while and started exploring other options because I just wasn't 100% sure that, you know, medicine was the thing. Dove into some tech, started working for a tech company, and kind of never looked back, just fell in love with tech. And then that was about the time that entrepreneurship started to become, there was a little momentum, there was kind of an ecosystem starting to form here in Utah. Silicon Slopes was starting to become a thing. This is super early kind of Silicon Slopes. And I thought, yeah, maybe tech and kind of entrepreneurship and that path is more, it was definitely more interesting to me than like when I was a kid. Yeah. I thought, I got to be a doctor. That's where the money's at, you know?
Talk to me about that, how you are able to incentivize and also the leadership skills, because it's really just a paradigm shift as to what roles and responsibilities that you take as a form of leadership to be able to recruit, right? So take us back to when you were starting to recruit, right? And how even at a young age, the foundational approaches to how you recruit can still be applied today. And how do you, as a leader, how do you do that?
That's a good question. I mean, when I was a kid, and I guess there is carryover, there is some mm-hmm. similarities to doing that as an adult. But when I was a kid, it was just pure passion mm-hmm. and excitement. And I guess I was good at selling my friends on this idea that, like, hey, if we all get together and we do like these three lemonade stands, we're going to make like so much money, and we're going to be like, we're going to be able to go to the Sev and we're going to be able to buy slushies and like Big League Chew and like all the cool stuff. I'd sell this vision of like, if we work our butts off, then like, here's what we can do with it, and paint a picture, I guess, of like this future potential really cool thing. And as an adult, recruiting people and building a company and building teams is similar in the sense that you have to be passionate, really passionate about the idea. You have to have a really clear vision of how you're going to accomplish that idea, and then show the team and kind of sell the team on, here's how we're going to get there and here's what it's going to be like, and it's going to be so amazing and it's going to be really cool. The difference between doing it as a kid and as an adult is it's not just about the Slurpees and the Big League Chew. It's not just about the payout. There's a purpose in what you do. And to really motivate people, it has to be bigger than just the monetary reward. I've learned that people really need to believe in the mission, in the purpose, in the why. And if they believe that you're doing something that they can get excited about and that they can get behind, that they believe in whatever field or whatever area it is, they feel like they're accomplishing something meaningful, that it's an opportunity for them to grow personally as an individual, but also be a part of a team, a collective group that's trying to accomplish something amazing, there's a lot of fulfillment in that. And yes, the money matters. I'm not saying it's yeah. all missionary work necessarily, but the money matters. But I've also learned that the money is not enough if that's the only thing. It can't just be about the monetary reward. There has to be real purpose mm-hmm. and accomplishment, and people have to believe in the mission. They have to believe that what they're doing is meaningful and makes a difference somehow.
Yeah. For everyone out there, there may be some people listening that are either starting their company or have already started and are managing, you know, teams. Mm-hmm. So can you speak to how to create that winning culture and continue to create buy-in mm-hmm. for the culture? Because there's multiple narratives that can be created. One, to attract the customer that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Two, for the internal organization to continue to sell them mm-hmm. on what that looks like. So can you share with us a little bit deeper as to how you maintain that culture and what you're currently doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. It starts with, I think, I can't remember if it's a Clayton Christensen thing or a Jim Collins thing, but it's getting the right people on the bus. I can't remember who kind of came up with that idea. It might be Jim Collins. It's I think it's from Good to Great, so it must be like Jim Collins or something. But it's you got to have the right people on the team. And so in to create the right kind of culture, you have to be really good at recruiting in the first place. Or sometimes in my career, I've adopted a team that already existed, but my first step was to really get to know everybody on the team at a really, you know, deep level, like what their hobbies, personalities, like what their motivations are, what their, you know, family life is like, what their dreams and aspirations are, like really, really try to get to know them, because I want to know that everybody on the team is excited about what we're doing and really passionate about it. And they're not just looking at it as a job. Mm-hmm. Now there's plenty of careers out there that, especially at massive scale, you know, maybe like a Walmart or something like that, like where it's hard that every single employee is passionate about the mission. I mean, they're at some point you probably like there's people who are just doing it for a job and you know, they need the job and that's great. But especially in a startup, where you have a small group of people, it is absolutely critical that every single person is 100% bought into the mission. They know what the mission is, so there's clarity around that and a vision, but they love and are excited about what you're trying to accomplish, and they're not just looking at it as a paycheck, right? So I really either try to recruit people who are excited about this idea and are really, really committed to the idea. I also try to recruit or surround myself with people who are very complementary in backgrounds. And by complementary, I do not mean the same. I mean diverse, actually. Mm-hmm. But complement each other in like different sets of strengths and weaknesses and different types of backgrounds and different types of perspectives, such that if there's a group of really, really smart people that have different opinions and think slightly differently than each other, then you've got the best chance at coming out with like the best possible idea, because you have pretty intense debates or discussions, and not everyone's just a yes man and just agreeing with each other. Like you have pretty intense differences of opinion, but collectively you can come up with a brilliant idea that no one individual on the team maybe could have thought of just by themselves, but like this kind of wrestling back and forth with something, you come out the other end with like a really, you know, brilliant outcome.
Every business has its ups and downs, and there's the war room, as you would call it, right? Yeah. But there's this one common goal and purpose that everyone on that ship is trying to go towards.
Yeah.
So share with us a little bit about how you navigate the interpersonal conflicts and conflict resolution within the organization. So take us back to maybe a time that you had a struggle, but you came out on top, and now you are thriving through that conflict.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting thing, especially for me to kind of think about. Early in my career, I was the head of product. And there was a really brilliant head of engineering, but we butted heads so hard. And I love him now. Like I kind of always loved him, but like we fought, like we really butted heads. And it was weird because it's almost like we would just be ready to punch each other in the face, at work. But weirdly, if I ever would have needed help, or if I would have gotten trouble, like flat tire, you know, outside of work, he probably would have been the first one I would call, because I trusted him and respected him. But we really saw things differently and butted heads quite a bit. And as part of that struggle, I was looking for solutions, and I was introduced to the Arbinger Institute, and they have a book called Leadership and Self-Deception. I mean, they have multiple books now, but the first one I was introduced to is called Leadership and Self-Deception. And the core premise of this book is, in interpersonal relationships, we have the choice to see other people as people or to see them as objects. And Arbinger refers to this, based on tons of, you know, psychology and philosophy and history, that when you're able to see every person, as a real human being, you're in the responsive way of being towards that person. When you see people as objects, you're in a resistant way of being towards that person. You're rejecting their humanity. And when you see someone as an object, they might be an obstacle, they might be a vehicle, or they might be irrelevant. But you're not seeing a human being, and you're not treating them as a human being. And when I started to get exposed to that idea, that kind of framework, and I started to see this coworker as a person instead of an object. And a lot of times I saw him as an obstacle because I saw a clear path to product success and what the customers wanted. And I was talking to the customers every day and he was hiding in his little, you know, dev cave. You know, it was funny. Like we'd argue about this stuff. I'm like, I know what the customers want. You don't. When I started to be able to see him as a person and it gave me the ability to have a little perspective on where he was coming from, why he was so adamant about things, and maybe why he was arguing for different things, it totally changed the nature of our relationship. Now, fast forwarding, you know, 20 or 30 years from there, the more I've been able to apply that, not just in work relationships, but even in personal relationships with my spouse, with my kids, with neighbors, this ability to see other people as people and be in a responsive way of being, certainly not perfect at it. In fact, it's a constant kind of mindset that you have to be, you know, and then from minute to minute, like 1 minute I might be very resistant towards my wife and then other times I'll be really responsive. So it's a constant kind of battle. But the more you're able to see other people as people, it makes a huge difference. So applying that towards a team and applying that towards a culture, I've exposed every one of my teams over the years to this idea, this concept, and to the book. Like we read the book, we talk about it. And I try to set a framework for saying, hey, the more we as a team are able to see each other as people and not as objects, whether it's a vehicle or an obstacle or irrelevant, the more successful we'll be. That doesn't mean that we have to agree with each other. In fact, I expect and I kind of want like strong differences of opinion. But when you're seeing someone as a person, when you're disagreeing with them, you can disagree with someone in a very responsive way. It's not personal. It's not like they're a jerk or they're an idiot. There's no labels like that. You're just like, hey, here's my opinion and here's why I have this opinion. Mm-hmm. And then you're able to listen to their strong opinion and why they have that opinion. And your only goal is how do we come out the other end with like the best possible solution? And when you're both in a responsive way of being, you can, or a group of people are collectively in a responsive way of being towards each other, you can have those strong disagreements, but then come to a resolution. And even if it's still not the idea that you personally wanted, you can say, okay, I had the opportunity to voice my opinion. We as a team decided to collectively go this other direction. But now I had the chance to disagree. Now I'm going to commit. And as a team player, I'm all in on what the team has decided. And that's kind of another, you know, famous thing that I think has been incorrectly attributed to Jeff Bezos, but was, I think, inspired by Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems or someone way before Jeff Bezos that he learned it from, the concept of disagree, then commit. That's possible and works if the team can all be in a responsive way of being towards each other and they can see each other as people.
Yeah, I always say, and it's about the seeking to understand as opposed to the quick judgment, right?
Yeah.
We make snap judgments,
yeah.
But understanding those snap judgments and understanding how we respond to others is, you know, extremely important. So at your leadership within the company that you are now at the helm of, share with us a little bit about the actual company that you have now developed, the problem that you have seen in the market,
yeah,
and your ambitious, futuristic thought process and how you are addressing.
My total world domination plan.
Yeah, and how you're going to address that.
That's good. Yeah. So this gives me the opportunity to say, it was a great introduction, by the way, but I'm actually not the founder.
Okay.
So I should be clear about the fact that there were a group of three really brilliant individuals who were the founders. They started the company almost 2 years ago. Originally, it was called PiFi. And their idea from the beginning was Venmo for equity. Like, how could we make it really easy as Venmo, for private companies to give small amounts of their equity to their partners, to influencers and brand ambassadors, to their customers, to their community, in the case of like sports teams, to their fans? How could we take this stuff that previously has been locked up pretty tight, private company equity, and available to only a handful of people through, you know, option grants or
shares,
like, you know, owners or founders equity or to like big cash investors? How could we give everybody that's contributing to the success of a group or a company or a team, how could we give them a piece of the pie? How could we give them
PiFi
some ownership? And that's the PiFi came from, like, give them a piece of the pie.
Yeah.
Pi finance or whatever, right? Yeah. So they started it, and there was an opportunity at that time. Crypto was blowing up in a positive way. It was like, you know, growing like crazy. Blockchain and Web3 were really hot topics. And the idea, the philosophy behind Web3 and building communities and where every member of the community can participate and be a contributor to the success instead of the old kind of top-down small ownership kind of philosophy, they bought into that whole philosophy, which we're still, you know, very much believers in, and I'm personally a believer in, which is why I was excited to join the group a little bit later. But they started building all this stuff on the blockchain, did all this stuff with crypto, and then, you know, crypto, you know, went crazy. I don't know how to say it. Like, all the craziness of like the wild, wild west of kind of crypto has kind of, you know, created a lot of chaos and a lack of trust. And so organizations and brands and other people are like, you know, we're nervous about like being involved in crypto. Mm-hmm. But the underlying philosophy was still really, really powerful. So about 6 months ago, maybe a little longer, they decided to pivot away from it being crypto, still have all of that underlying architecture, but just started to focus on it. This is just for normal fiat currency, normal equity. And the legal stuff that we built, that they built, which we invested over $1 million and about 18 months of kind of going through a lot of like regulatory compliance stuff, a lot of legal kind of paperwork. We've built this really powerful and unique infrastructure that is IRS compliant, that's SEC compliant. It's totally legal, totally on the up and up. And that is probably our secret sauce. It's actually not the tech. We built some really cool tech, but our secret sauce really is all of this legal infrastructure that we've built, which we're the first ones to do. Nobody else is doing what we're doing. There were some other crypto companies that were dabbling in that kind of space, but they've basically, you know, struggled and either gone out of business with being all in on the crypto stuff. These guys kind of had the foresight and maybe the wisdom to say we want to do crypto and be a part of the crypto thing, but we're not all. It's not only crypto. It's mm-hmm. really about the ownership in whatever form that needs to take. So I joined in August, was brought in by Kickstart, who is our lead investor, fantastic VC firm that I've had a long relationship with. They invited me to come and meet the team, fell in love with the team, amazing group. There were seven people on the team, and I would be then the eighth person to join. And we ended up going through a rebranding process because there was some potential trademark conflicts with PiFi, especially if we got, you know, really big. So we went through a rebranding process and had a bunch of names that we were thinking about, and then ended up with Awesome, which has been really, really fun from a marketing perspective. AWSM, and we were able to get the .com. I had some connections there. We also got the .co, and we've got, you know, all the surrounding domains. We're in the process of trademarking that in our segments that we care about, which is kind of fintech mm-hmm. and consumer software, that kind of thing. And it all centered around this idea that still from the day one, the original idea is this idea that ownership is awesome. And therefore, awesome is ownership. So our company is built on this idea that it's really cool or awesome to be able for companies to be able to use small amounts of their equity to reward and motivate customers, which is where the real magic is, because in the past, companies that have tried to give people equity outside of their core leadership team, it is a massive amount of paperwork. It's a huge effort. It's back and forth with lawyers and accountants. It's a nightmare. But they were able to do it with maybe like a handful of influencers or maybe a mm-hmm. agency partner or two or something. But it was like still like, you know, 3, 4, 5 people. And then that was it. Like, it's just too much of a mess. It's, you know, adding too many people to your cap table. So the idea or even the thought that what if you could do this with like 1,000 customers or 10,000 customers or 1,000,000 customers is kind of mind blowing, but that's what we've done. So with a single entity on a business's cap table, we create something called the collective for that brand. So it's the brand collective. Using our software combined with our legal infrastructure, that brand with that single entity can have an unlimited number of members of that collective, and they don't have to be accredited investors. They're not buying equity, they're earning equity. And they can earn this equity through a variety of different actions, which can be being loyal to a brand, signing up for a membership or a subscription, buying a certain amount of stuff within a certain period of time. One cool thing, like instead of taking a discount in the checkout, convert it to equity and pay full price, but then you have ownership. So instead of getting 20% off your shirt or your bag or whatever, you pay full price, but you get that 20% in the form of equity in the brand. Now you're an owner. You have a piece of the pie. And the idea is that if that brand is one that you love and support anyway, and you're going to be out there, you're probably way more likely as a consumer to be more evangelical, tell your friends and family. You're definitely more likely to buy more. And when it comes down to like, do I buy this shirt or that shirt? And you've got ownership in one, you're going to buy the one that you have ownership in, mm-hmm. right? So for brands that are competitive, this is a fantastic way to say, the difference between us and them is that we give you ownership in our brand and you can get a piece of the pie and be successful with us. So they have all these really, we've unlocked the ability for brands to kind of take this loyalty and rewards concept to a whole new level. But it also works with rewarding and motivating influencers, giving them equity as part of the compensation for, you know, promoting your brand in public and on social media. Mm-hmm. It works with student athletes with NIL. So student athletes can earn equity ownership in the local brands and companies that they promote and support. Which is cool for them because it's playing the long game. You know, as a student athlete, some of them will go pro, some of them won't. But if they get equity ownership while they're a student and they're promoting these brands, like that could be meaningful amount of money as mm-hmm. it grows and becomes something, you know, down the road.
Can you create multiple lines?
Well, a single of equity collective. You can have an unlimited number of members and have been different types of members. So okay, in the same collective, you can have agency partners doing like marketing and branding and dev work for you. You can have the influencers and brand ambassadors. And then you can also have an unlimited number of customers, all as part of, they're all members of that single collective. So one entry on the cap table and essentially an unlimited number of people that you can share a fraction of your equity with. Now, the other question we get is like, well, do we have to carve out like 30% of our cap table? That seems crazy. I'm like, no, I mean, 5%, 10%, maybe. It's crazy how the amount of ownership someone has is not the thing. The psychology is the same for someone who has like $5 of ownership as it is for someone who has $5,000 of ownership. I can't explain it. Mm. All I'm saying is that that's the observation and that's the psychology. It's crazy. It's maybe even irrational, mm-hmm. but we're leaning into that irrationality.
Yeah.
The fact that brands can get evangelical kind of raving fans and they might only have $5 worth of ownership. It's kind of crazy, but it works.
Well, it's truly like getting behind somebody who's doing great things. I mean, just recently we both experienced a young talent at a event that was hosted here in Salt Lake.
Yeah, we should say his name. Silas Luke Jones. Oh, my gosh.
And
I don't know if he'll be listening to this, but anyone who hasn't heard that name, go Google it mm-hmm. or go on Instagram or whatever right now. Mm-hmm. Go on YouTube. This kid who is now 17, but when you met him, he was like 15. Mm-hmm. Can play the guitar like probably no one I've ever seen. And I've been to seen mm-hmm. like some of the best guitarists in the world. Like he's mind blowing.
So my point was behind that. It's like, you want to get behind somebody who's going somewhere, right? Yeah. So for example, we want to get behind brands that we know, like, love, trust that are going somewhere. Right. Question for you. Do you have a awesome for awesome?
Yes. We eat our own dog food. It's a fantastic question. So, we have a collective
awesome.
On our cap table, and we give equity rewards to people who bring us brands, like the people who refer us. So we have a bunch of agency partners that they work with the consumer brands, and the brands are the ones that pay us. So for students and for customers and for the recipients of the equity, it's free platform, right? They get the equity. Mm-hmm. The ones that pay us are the brands who are using us to manage and distribute and keep track of all of those people.
Okay.
So that's they pay us a SaaS monthly fee mm-hmm. to manage all of that for them. And we save them literally hundreds of thousands of dollars compared to if they tried to do that, you know, through
the legal
paperwork. And for individual customers, like, it would just be unfeasible. That's why nobody's ever done it.
So walk me through this customer journey right now. I've got a SMB, you know, small to medium sized business.
Yeah.
Just walk me through that process. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Help me create this.
Yeah. So we set you up with your collective, which is an entity that you put on your cap table. Then you decide how much of your equity you want to put into that pool that's managed by your collective. And that doesn't have to be a one-time decision. You can start like really small to test it out. And then as it's working, you can always add more equity into that pool, right?
Do you need to be a C Corp, S Corp, or LLC?
Any
how
of those,
do you want to deal with
this? But you have to be US and private.
Okay.
Can't
US
be a publicly traded company, can be any form US private company. We have total world domination plans to go international, but mm-hmm. right now all the laws and all that compliance stuff that we've set up is based on US law. The recipients of the equity can be anywhere. They can be international, but the company itself has to be a US entity. Then we can either do an internal valuation for you to like set the value of that equity, because that will determine like what types of rewards you're giving people. It has to be tied to like a monetary value, mm-hmm. right? Or if you've had a recent 409A valuation mm-hmm. from a third-party firm, we have a great relationship with Scalar, which is a firm that does, you know, 409As for people. So they can do it for you, or we can do what we call a valuation estimate, which is kind of a more simple form of evaluation. You couldn't use ours for tax purposes or for raising money from like legit mm-hmm. investors and
yes.
stuff, but it's good enough for the IRS to say, okay, a third party has determined a fair value for this equity. Mm-hmm. The brand can't set the value of the equity themselves, right? So you wouldn't be able to just say, this is what I'm worth. It has to be done by a third party.
As a recipient of equity from Awesome or from a company that is now that we just set up, right?
Yeah.
I want to distribute out. So now I'm a customer.
Yeah.
What do I receive in the form of a compensation other than just equity? Is there any monetary value to that equity?
Yeah, it can be cash. And like any kind of payout, even to customers, but to influencers, to agency partners, they can get part of their compensation in cash and part of it in equity. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. In fact, with agencies and influencers, it's almost always a mix. Mm-hmm. So an agency might say, hey, we're going to do this huge campaign for you, brand, and we want 50% in cash, and then we'll take 50% in equity. And then we manage that equity portion as far as the record keeping. The brand, they're the agency can log into our platform and they can see their equity ownership, and they can even see as it goes up in value, as the brand's value goes up. Mm-hmm. And the agency could then also have ownership in 10 different brands. Okay. And all on that single dashboard, they can say, okay, here's all the brands. Here's the equity we have with each one of those brands. Here's the charts about how the brand's equity is going up. So they have a really cool dashboard that they can see all of that on. Same thing for a customer, although customer doesn't really get cash. They earn equity either, like I said, I'm not going to take a 20% discount. I'm just going to convert that to equity. Or, hey, I'm going to sign up for this membership. Mm-hmm. And as part of my membership, I get $10 a month in equity from this brand. Or, hey, I get a referral code and I'm going to refer my friends and family. I'm not an influencer, but I got 20 people that I want to tell about this brand. And for every one of those people that buy something, I get 10% of their purchase in the form of equity. And okay. I can see my dashboard and I can see all these little activities that I'm doing to earn equity. And what's magic about the Awesome platform is that we do all of that automatically. It's mm-hmm. not like someone at the brand has to like constantly be monitoring like some spreadsheet. You yes. don't have to manually push all these buttons. You set it up and then all of this stuff happens automagically, basically.
Automagically, that's right. That's what AI is for, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're not using AI. It's funny how some people say AI when it's not really AI. It's automated stuff.
Automagically.
It's just automagic, yeah.
Yeah, well, let's just keep it at automagic. That's right. The secret awesome sauce.
That's the secret awesome sauce.
That's what they say. Yeah. Okay, so I'm a customer. Is there an onboarding process? And then is there a tiered pricing on the size of the organization that wants to get started?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've got two kind of base prices. There's like an enterprise level monthly fee and then a startup monthly fee.
Okay.
And then there's also a variable component to either of those. So as the volume of distributions and the size of distributions increases, then you pay us a percentage of that.
Okay.
So it scales from, you know, a really, really small startup to massive.
Millions.
Yeah,
billions.
Huge, huge brand. Yeah.
Okay. I see that.
Yeah.
Dang. Wow. So you're not necessarily, there's a problem, but you're making it.
It's
kind
more
of a big
an
deal.
Opportunity.
Yeah, an opportunity.
So I want to talk about that a little bit. The problem that we're solving for brands is there's a couple. One is cash flow management. It's a huge challenge for brands because when they're thinking about how to leverage their cash as intelligently as possible, they're thinking about, okay, we've got to do an ad buy, or we have to pay this agency, or we have to pay this influencer a certain amount to like get this thing going. If they're able to use equity for even a portion of that, they save that cash up front and they don't have to pay it until some later point in time, well after they've realized the revenues for that thing. So from a cash flow management strategy, there's some genius kind of magic. Most people will be like, what does that even mean? But the CFOs listening right now should be getting goosebumps. They should be getting like a little spidey tingle of like, oh my gosh, that's pretty
brilliant.
Cool. Then the other thing is that there's a cash component to it, especially with margins. If a customer or let's say you message this to all of your customers, the math that we've seen so far is about 20% will opt into like, hey, I want equity ownership. So it's not 100%, but even 20% are motivated by these kind of opportunities. So if 20% of all the people that bought stuff on Black Friday for a brand paid full price instead of taking any kind of discount, but they still bought, the brand realizes the top line revenue that they got, but their margin goes up maybe even 1 point, that could be worth $1 million. Mm-hmm. It has massive kind of financial implications for the brand. Then they get this extra benefit of once people have ownership, they usually spend twice as much. They are loyal three times longer. They are 74% more likely to refer friends and family to the brand. They're more likely to leave positive reviews, and they're more likely to create user-generated content. So the brand, once they have owners in the form of customers, suddenly like increase all of these KPIs and all of these things that they really, really care about. It is like there's no other loyalty rewards program that can touch this. And we don't market ourselves as a loyalty rewards program, but we're helping the brand accomplish all the things that they were doing with a, you know, loyalty and rewards program.
But just like we touched on earlier, the psychology behind ownership.
Yeah.
It'll excite anybody.
It's
regardless of the size, crazy. Right?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And like, people have seen glimpses of this. If anyone has a friend or family member that's a Green Bay Packers fan,
yes,
or you know any of these teams that have given like ownership to the fans, it's funny that fans are like, "I'm an owner." I mean, they might have like $10 or $20 worth of ownership, but they're crazy. It's next level commitment. It's next level loyalty.
Yeah.
So like I said, it's not rational, but a lot of things in purchasing and in loyalty and in that kind of stuff are way more emotional than they are rational. And the brand can capitalize on that. And again, it's not manipulative. I don't think it's insincere. It's like, hey, thank you, customer, for being a part of our journey, for helping us, supporting us. It's bringing all of these people that traditionally you might have thought or the brand might have thought of as outsiders,
yes,
making them insiders, making them a part of the family, a part of the community, and saying, thank you for being loyal. Thank you for referring your friends. Thank you for supporting us. Here's a little piece of the pie. And if we all win together, this little piece that you have could be worth 2 times, 5 times, 10 times down the road, and everybody wins.
We just want to be an insider of awesome. I mean, I want to be a super fan of this awesome brand, and you know, I already am.
Thanks.
You came on the podcast for a reason. We're excited to hear obviously more about your story. So tell us a little bit about the future, what you're excited about,
yeah,
what your roadmap is looking like, and then also what are you looking for?
Okay, that's great. And thank you for this opportunity. Without sounding like a total crazy person, Awesome has the potential to work for and with every private company on the planet. But even if you just look at every private company in the United States, every private company could use Awesome to reward and motivate their community. That can even include employees. The ones who have traditionally been excluded from ownership can start to get a piece of the pie. Again, the agency partners, customers in all their forms. So the hard thing for us has been when you have a solution that could really be powerful for everyone, where do you start? And that's what we've had to have a tremendous amount of discipline around, like who do we start with? Where do we begin? And we kind of settled on starting with consumer brands, because they have these 4 different types of relationships that can all benefit from ownership. The agency partners, the influencers and brand ambassadors, the customers, and their employees. All 4 of those relationships can benefit from a brand having this, you know, ability to have awesome, right? But the Total World Domination plan is we're going to build a marketplace that is similar to like a Salesforce or HubSpot or something, where our API libraries are accessible to third-party developers. And anyone would be able to come on and say, I'm going to build an awesome app or an awesome plugin or an awesome extension. And it can be totally white labeled. Like we don't even really care about, like, it's not like we have to get all the publicity. We want to enable every company to be able to leverage this in a powerful way. So someone could come and say, hey, I'm going to write the awesome app for fantasy sports, or I'm going to write the awesome app for hotels, or I'm going to write the awesome app for cruise lines, or I'm going to write the awesome app for restaurant chains. Whatever you want to do, and you see an opportunity to say, hey, unlocking ownership in this particular category or this niche could be incredibly powerful. In my lifetime, we're not going to be able to build all of the solutions for this because the TAM is so big.
Yeah.
So we want to enable hundreds or thousands of developers to partner with us to build these solutions in these different categories, leverage our APIs, and leverage the really powerful legal infrastructure that we've built so they don't have to jump through that 18 months of hoops and you know, million-dollar investment themselves. And then rev share with them, and everybody wins. Again, we have this mentality of like everybody can win, everybody can participate in the upside, and that's the total world domination.
Yeah,
your
mentality is strong for sure. You know, so how can we be of service to you, the community of the Founders Odyssey? Because we want to be a support.
Yeah,
so
great question.
Share with us.
We eat our own dog food. So bring me consumer brands, and if they sign up for Awesome, I'll give you equity in Awesome.
Okay.
We do that for all of our referral partners. So we'd love like any consumer brands, a private consumer brands, bring them to us, any size. And we the biggest thing for us is that because this has never been possible and we're the only ones doing it, the biggest hurdle we have is just education.
Education.
Just getting the word out, saying, hey, did you even know that this was possible? And even some of the people we reach out to are still like, are you sure? Or, you know, is that real? Like, there's still a little bit of doubt, right? So we're just onboarding our first customers. We're just starting to create our first case studies. And we're trying to build all this content to try and educate people that it's even possible. And then the more people start to hear about it, and again, this is the fun part of the marketing is I tell somebody like what we do and naturally without thinking, they're like, oh, that's awesome. I'm like, yeah, it literally is.
It's the very first time. No, it is the very first time I ever heard your pitch when you stood up at one of the events out here in Salt Lake. I was like, dang, that's awesome. And literally, you know, your name was
everybody
awesome.
Everybody like catches themselves and they're like, oh, damn it. I'm like, I mean, we did that on purpose, right?
Yeah.
It's fun to be able to say like, that's awesome. Mm. But we genuinely believe it. It's not a gimmick. We believe that that is awesome.
Yeah.
We believe that that is the awesome way brands can win and build community and separate themselves from their competitors and be unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess I should throw in there too. Right now we have the ability to give brands exclusivity in their category. So, you know, when it's kind of like when everyone has a punch card, buy nine and get the 10th one free, then nobody has a punch card because then there's no motivation for me to, if I've got a punch card for every restaurant, it's, you know, it's not the deciding factor on which restaurant I go to.
Yeah.
But if there was a restaurant chain that offered equity ownership every time I ate food there and they were the only ones in that category,
I mean, there
are
a lot.
I'm only eating there.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's what we want to unlock.
Okay.
So there's some cool stuff we can do there.
Well, listen, out there, they've spent over $1 million on legal, you know, the legal complexities of this to make sure that you don't have to. And that's another awesome trait that you guys have unlocked. So if everybody out there wants to hop on Awesome, it's...
Awesome.
Where's the website?
AWSM.com.
Okay. And then how do you have social channels or how do people reach out to you?
On all of the social platforms, we are at Real Awesome. R-E-A-L-A-W-S-M.
Okay.
Real Awesome.
Real Awesome.
And I think I'm David Oldham on LinkedIn. I'm super active on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. So reach out. Yeah.
Perfect.
Come to our website. Sign up for a demo, reach out, you know, contact us, and we'd love to work with you.
Well, let's help Awesome become the next, what do they call it, unicorn out of out of Utah. So once again, thank
Unicorn's too low. We're setting our sights on like Decacorn or something cool like that. Yeah.
I like that. Well, listen, thank you so much for listening to the Founders Odyssey podcast. And if you guys have liked today's episode, feel free to subscribe and let's help Dave and Awesome get out to the world by simply just sharing this podcast with any entrepreneur, any private-based consumer brand who's wanting to distribute equity to people that are interested in becoming super fans of your awesome brand as well as Awesome that helps to facilitate. So once again, my name is Nathan Bird, and thank you so much for joining us on the Founders Odyssey podcast.